Welcome back to our pre-hospital critical care curriculum podcast. I'm Andrew.
I'm Stefan.
I'm Chris.
This is module number two, ventilation and the management of pulmonary emergencies. And this is chapter two, focusing on the differentiation and treatment of respiratory failure in the pre-hospital setting. In today's podcast, we're also going to review the CRM topic for this month, and that is leadership. We're joined here today by Dr. David Lang, who's new to the podcast, as well as paramedic Rob Gemmel, who you've all had the pleasure of listening to in the past. So I think I'd like to get Dave to introduce himself. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your training, where you're from, etc.?
Hi there. I'm David Lang. I work in an emergency department over at Waitemata District Health Board, and also here at the HEMS base, and I'm also USAR, New Zealand USAR, the Urban Search and Rescue Team.
So for today's podcast, we're going to use a couple of cases to try and generate a bit of discussion amongst our expert panel. We're going to give a fairly broad case of someone who has respiratory failure, and then we're going to get our panel to tell us how they would diagnose and differentiate what might be going on with this person, and then how they'd treat this person in the pre-hospital setting. I think what we should do to start with is give us our first case. So it's a 65-year-old gentleman who's got a past medical history of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and is a current smoker. He's had a heart attack in the past, and he's on a whole heap of drugs, including antihypertensives and diuretics. He's also recently been on holiday to San Francisco and arrived back in Auckland 3 days ago. And surprise, surprise, given it's a respiratory podcast, he's complaining of shortness of breath. His vital signs when you arrive are a heart rate of 115, a blood pressure of 110 over 68, a respiratory rate of 30, his oxygen sat at 86% in room air, and he's got a temperature of 37.5. So I think you'd agree it's a fairly common presentation that we get called to go and see. But what we'd like to do is get an idea of what your approach is to working out what's going on with this patient and what's going through your head. So if we start with you, Rob, when you're sat in the back of the helicopter flying to this patient, what's going through your brain?
Well, first up, I'm thinking, thank you for this scenario, because it's got to be one of the most complex patients to firstly assess and then secondary treat. Elderly patients that have this element of medical comorbidity are extremely hard pre-hospitally to differentially diagnose. But my general approach is, provided there's no immediate primary assessment threats that I need to address immediately, it's all about stratifying which pathologies are going to kill this patient first. So identifying the ones that are going to kill them quicker than the others, and either identifying them or eliminating them as soon as I can. Secondary to that is also considering the pathologies that are more likely to be present with this patient. You know, elderly, element of heart disease, element of cord. Have they had a long-standing younger time history of asthma, and trying to identify or eliminate those ones as well. So I don't think there's pre-hospitally there's any magic recipe to actually sort of wave your wand and say, yep, I'm going to hedge all my bets on this particular pathology and stick with that. I think with elderly patients, multiple comorbidities, probably polypharmacy, you know, you need to have an open mind that there could be elements of all sorts of pathologies going on all at the same time. So, you know, it's a very delicate balance to sort of assess and then treat.
Thanks, Rob. Dave, could you give some insight on how you would assess and treat this patient?
Certainly. Just to reiterate what Rob said, this has an absolute wide open differential diagnosis, and in my mind, I always like to think of the different phases of treatment that may be possible. You may have elements of resuscitation, you have elements of specific care, and you may have supportive elements ongoing, and they may all overlap. And what I really want to know about is not only just what is the most likely primary diagnosis, but that may be less important in an acute uncontrolled setting like the pre-hospital setting than what is the primary physiological threat, a little bit like what Rob was saying, that I'm actually resuscitating. So the actual diagnosis may be a little less important initially than what is the primary life threat and physiological disturbance that I'm going to actually treat.
So, Steph, I think this is a good time to take a step back and quickly review some of the important points that Rob and Dave have made. Before we jump into that, though, there was something you wanted to add to the discussion.
Yeah, before I take any physical findings, I look at the scene survey. I always do a scene survey. What's going on for the patient? Are they under 300 blankets? Do they have any meds beside the bed? Home oxygen? A cigarette tray full of butts, you know? I also take a history from bystanders. Family may be able to more accurately tell me what's going on. Maybe English is a second language. Maybe the patient's obtunded. I think taking an accurate history is useful.
So more clues than just speaking to the patient and examining the patient.
Yeah, totally.
That's interesting because we don't have that luxury in the hospital. We see the patient comes in, we're able to interact with them, but we don't have that ability to, like you said, perform that scene survey. To review the points that that Dave and Rob made that I think are very important. Number one, Rob said that anytime you arrive at a scene, you need to identify the life threats. And I think everybody would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Physiologic perturbations are changes in physiology that need to be treated immediately should trump trying to diagnose the underlying pathology in any patient initially.
I agree. There are times when that maybe isn't as important, maybe when distance and time are affected.
It's very true. For us, we have the luxury of short transport distances. Our longest flight time would probably be about 40 minutes.
Yeah.
But again, if you're transporting a patient, you know, for 5, 6, 7 hours, understanding that underlying pathology and having a treatment plan in place, I think is probably very relevant.
Yeah, that anticipatory clinical course becomes way more important, doesn't it?
I agree. So let's get back into the discussion.
Okay.
Thinking about this patient, there's a large differential. You've beautifully crafted a case that has elements of potential COPD exacerbation, reactive airways disease, acute ischemic heart disease versus heart failure versus pulmonary embolism versus infection versus it can go on and on and on. So the bottom line is keeping the patient alive. So from that case, the first primary life threat that we've identified is that the patient is significantly hypoxic and they have significant rate, at least, of breathing. We don't yet know about work of breathing. We assume it's high. So those would be the initial thoughts that would cross my mind.
So this brings to my mind two sort of specific questions that I'd like you both to have a crack at answering. The first is, are there any tips or tricks to the physical exam, given the constraints of the gear that we have, that can help start you down that road in terms of trying to solidify a differential diagnosis? And number two, how does the team dynamic come into play with a doctor and a paramedic in this situation where you've clearly identified two tasks? One is initially getting the resuscitation up and going. The second is to try and complete that scene survey and gather information and then share that mental model. So I don't know which one of you wants to tackle either question first. Dave?
So tackling the pre-hospital team question, I mean, I think one of the beauties of the pre-hospital team is it's small and flexible and people know each other well. And those are some huge advantages over an in-hospital team where we often are working with practitioners who have never worked together and there's very large and ungainly teams. So often we can actually get away with much better team dynamics in the pre-hospital setting than we can in hospitals. So in that regard, I don't think there is necessarily a fixed way that it should always run. I think that the team members in the pre-hospital setting each have the skills to usually be able to competently fulfill a role. And obviously the beauty is that they can talk to each other and very rapidly establish where they want to fit and work together synergistically. So when someone arrives at a very uncertain scene like this case that we had presented to us, it usually takes a very short period of time to work out how you're going to divvy up your resources. Now, obviously, the docs on the team potentially have extended training in kind of complex decision-making in regards to kind of extensive medical possibilities. You know, that's a very convoluted way of putting it. And the paramedics tend to be amazing sort of knowing scenes and knowing resuscitation, especially pre-hospitally. So I think that those are sort of some broad stroke things, but the reality is they can both fulfill leadership roles, they can both fulfill kind of assessment roles or treatment roles very easily.
Do you think it's important to have an established leader prior to arriving to the scene? I do agree that that can flux, but do you think it's important that before the skids touch the ground, the team has decided that today I'm going to lead this case and you're going to be the bedside clinician or vice versa?
I'm always the leader. No, sorry. Joking aside. In my history working here at the ARHT so far, I haven't yet gone to jobs with it fixed in place. Sometimes on the way to a scene, when we've got good knowledge of the scene, I'll have a discussion with the other team members about where our likely skill sets will place us into fulfilling particular roles, and so we'll hit the ground with that as an initial working plan. And so often, for instance, it'll be a case that will be particularly have clear paramedic strengths, for instance, a car crash scene. And in that case, I'll be very directed by the paramedic. They'll be clearly the leader in that situation. I'll be specifically a technician capable of performing some higher level skills as far as procedures and a spare pair of hands. Whereas in other situations, it may be a medically complex case, and then I tend to potentially find myself in the leadership role as far as medical decision making in that case. But it's I've found it in my working experience to be a flexible situation.
It does make it very tricky, doesn't it? It's a situation where, in the pre-hospital setting, Rob, you'll be quite comfortable, but perhaps medically, David may have more skills to add. So how do you get around situations like that? We've done a lot of sim so far, where the fluid leadership role has occurred, and it hasn't always worked. Sometimes it has, and sometimes maybe not as good. What do you think? How do you think it works best?
Well, I'm a pretty easygoing kind of guy, to be honest. however, you know, I have had moments in my career where I like to be the boss, but you know, I will always concede that my training and experience pales in comparison to the physicians that we work with. And that's not trying to blow smoke up your guys' back passages. It's just stating the facts. You know, paramedics by default can't compete with 6 or so years of medical school plus all your in-hospital training on top of that. So when it comes to a complex medical patient like the one we're discussing today, you know, for pre-hospital clinicians, apart from the overt physiologic cues that we have, a lot of the stuff we do is kind of guessing game work, you know, address the things that are going to kill the patient first. And so, you know, I'm more than happy to rely on a physician like Dave to say, well, this is what I think it is based on XYZ, because XYZ are probably things that aren't even on my radar. So as long as each clinical team member has no ego about their role within the team, the team itself needs to perform as a unit for the benefit of the patient overall, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah, I like it.
Nicely said.
Okay, I think that's a really interesting discussion on the merits of different styles of leadership within a pre-hospital team. I'd like to get back a little bit to this 65-year-old who's short of breath.
So nobody's going to answer the first question?
There were no pearls there.
Let's assume for a moment that initial resuscitation's underway, and we'll touch on that a little bit in a moment. Starting with you, Rob, can you walk us down the clues that would point you towards one diagnosis over another? So the specific things in either the history or the examination or any basic tests that you can do pre-hospital that point you down either this is predominantly CORD or this is predominantly chronic heart failure or this is predominantly infection?
So probably medical history-wise is awfully, awfully important. And one of the first questions I'd be asking is, you know, do they have a cardiac history? And more particular, have they got a history of heart failure? The second question I want to ask in regards to history is there an element of CORD? Have they had asthma as in their youth? And has that then progressed on to CORD in later life? But physically, I wouldn't say you can easily differentiate those two particular pathologies, but, you know, you could look for jugular vein distension, maybe some hepatomegaly, maybe some peripheral edema. Have a listen to lung sounds, see what we can hear. Bronchoconstriction versus congestion versus pulmonary edema. None of those things are exact sciences, though, and that's the problem. That is the fundamental problem. And if Frank is listening out there, I will always thank you for the little gem of wisdom that Frank gave me, an old school paramedic who's working down country somewhere now. Frank, if you're listening, thank you very much. Stick a straw in a glass of treacle and blow air into it. And think of what that would probably sound like. Now stick a straw into a glass of water and blow into it. Have a think about what that would sound like. The difference between those two is water is probably more like pulmonary edema. The treacle is probably more like congestion, you know, pulmonary exudate. So, you know, little gems of, you know, passed on wisdom. I wouldn't say that's a definitive assessment tool, but, you know, little things like that has certainly helped me through my career.
I like that. I think that's really useful. It's little things like that that you've been taught and you remember that I think are really helpful when you're out actually looking at a patient. I do want to pick you up at the start where you gave me the textbook answer of looking for a JVP and feeling for hepatic congestion. How often do you actually do that when you're out on a job?
Well, in this particular scenario?
Yeah.
Every time.
And how easy is it in a dark, dingy front room on a cold winter's night to actually be able to see a JVP?
Awfully, awfully hard. But, you know, it's like that nice cuddly blanket that you've had since you were four. You know, you put it over your shoulders and it makes you feel comfy that you're actually doing something to, you know, to help your job or help the patient.
We do follow stereotypical behaviours that are very reassuring for us. And there is also a lot of merit in doing so because it's that structure that makes us more reproducible and more likely to find, because often not looking will lead to failure to find more so than the looking, and it's difficult. I mean, it's obviously a real challenge doing physical exam in the pre-hospital setting.
Another step back, Andrew?
I think, yeah, this is a very important point to reiterate, that when you're examining patients, especially in austere environments, you have to specifically take the time to look for certain findings. And these things are going to be subtle. And if you don't cognitively take the time to think about what you're looking for, things like that are easily, easily missed.
It takes a bit of discipline, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Let's get back into
it.
Do you have any tips and tricks that you use when you're clinically examining these patients pre-hospital?
None that spring to mind, other than the fact that, to reiterate what Rob said, they're all bad tests. So poor sensitivity, poor specificity, usually both, but combined together with multiple kind of features, as in parts of the history, parts of the exam, they can actually, combined with kind of a clinical acumen, suddenly it all falls together in your subconscious and you know exactly what's going on sometimes, but it's a difficult situation.
Can you comment on the use of ultrasound?
Yeah, definitely.
And its utility in helping to differentiate this type of a patient, what you would use it for and how you would use it?
So as far as a test we have at our disposal, it's probably the test best able to differentiate causes of acute shortness of breath, such as this case presents, you know, the wide differential. So if you can imagine, if you have the skills, you can ultrasound very quickly and easily for pneumothorax. That's a highly, you know, sensitive and specific test. One tricky thing is that a catastrophic COPD exacerbation can sometimes pull a false positive there with a lack of lung sliding. You can ultrasound for congestive heart failure, where you're looking for an alveolar interstitial syndrome with lots of rockets. You can ultrasound for the heart itself, looking for severe right heart strain with a pulmonary embolism question due to its recent travel. If you flash, you could start scanning his legs and find his DVT. It goes on and on and on. But the next question is that has to be balanced with timely care in the pre-hospital setting, because you could deviate off down a pathway where you're scanning for the next half an hour where the patient hasn't really been assisted much. And so you've got to juggle it between how much do you want your diagnosis versus how much do you want the patient to travel, versus is it actually going to change what you do in terms of resuscitation and getting them to where they need to be, their definitive destination.
So, Dave, I think that's a brilliant discussion, and you raised multiple valid points. My next question to you guys is, how do you use your pre-hospital interventions to sort of help guide the diagnostic algorithm?
So when there's a high degree of uncertainty between multiple differential diagnoses, I find intervention and response to intervention very helpful. And the other flip side to that is that I think that if there are interventions that are low risk in and of themselves but high clinical benefit, when there's uncertainty, I'll often use a barrage of treatments. For instance, you've got the patient with possible pneumonia versus COPD versus, you know, just reactive airways disease versus heart failure, then if the clinical picture looks like a bit of all of them, personally, I'm kind of going to treat all of them as long as I can't see a big danger to the treatment I'm choosing with what's in front of me. Because the reality is we like to think of Occam's razor and that there's likely to be only one problem going on, but as Rob mentioned before, this sort of patient, actually Occam's razor doesn't work very well. There's usually a multifactorial problem going on, and there may need to be treatments for different things happening in parallel. So thinking of a treatment, I'm going to start things, for instance, oxygen, and test its response, because you're going to be able to see from the administration of oxygen things like shunt physiology versus lack of shunt physiology. I'm going to obviously be cautious with too much oxygen and the dangers of hyperoxia in someone who is a CO2 retainer. I'm going to start with things like GTN if it looks like congestive heart failure, but being aware of the dangers of hypotension and reduced preload. You're going to think about bronchodilators, once again worrying about the fact that they could ramp the heart a bit. But all of these dangers of these treatments are seldom particularly high, and the response to treatment may guide you towards what's underlying, primary underlying physiological problem when they improve in relation to that treatment. A tricky thing with combining treatments is that sometimes it can be hard working out, if you could throw them all at the patient, which one's actually done the benefit. So you might want to try and work out how you're going to stage them, if that's appropriate, to work out what's helpful. But, you know, that's a very difficult and subtle thing to juggle.
Rob, so your approach to, do you stay and play or do you load and go? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think the clinical interventions that Dave was, Dave was just describing, nitrate therapy, bronchodilators, they're all relatively easy agents to administer on the fly. Mm. Unless we're having to actively and aggressively resuscitate a critical patient in regards to intubating respiratory failure prior to flight, then I see no reason why you can't perform some critical tasks like IV access, setting up some gear, and then loading and administering those agents on the way. The difficult decision making comes when you have a patient who's borderline, where you may not emergently be doing any, say, advanced airway care immediately, but you downstream foresee or anticipate you may have a problem. And what you don't want to do is then be put in a position where you've not fully anticipated complete derangement of physiology, mental status in flight, and then having to act upon it as you go. So I think the rule of thumb is, if you've got significant critical intervention to perform before flight, do it before flight. If you anticipate that you may encounter some difficulty and require critical intervention in flight, definitely prepare for it before flight. But otherwise, those lesser invasive procedures like administering those agents, yeah, there's no reason why you can't do it as you're going.
It takes a bit of experience to make those calls, doesn't it, really?
Mm.
Do you think, you mentioned in flight, do you think you always have to return to the hospital via a plane, not via a helicopter? Or would you consider going on the road with those patients that are in between?
Oh, yeah, possibly, absolutely. You know, it's much easier to transport by air a patient who is unstable but intubated. Yeah, you don't want to be managing that patient's airway in flight. So if you have the facility and it's reasonable to transport by road a patient who isn't intubated, but is that sort of borderline, are they going to crash on me or are they going to hold their own? You might elect just to go by road. It's not an easy decision to make when you're at the tip of Coromandel because, well, it is really, because the only way it goes by air. Yeah. But certainly, you need to have all those factors in the back of your mind and make an educated decision at the time.
It's those grey zones, that 35-minute drive time versus a 10-minute flight time, that's the real difficult ones, I think.
Yep, indeed.
So, Steph, I think this is a good time to put the brakes on this discussion.
It was an excellent discussion.
We focused a lot on adult respiratory emergencies, and I think there was a great discussion on leadership and team dynamics. The overall podcast that we've taped is over an hour, so we've decided to split it. Mm. So sort of chapter one of this part of the podcast will focus on adult respiratory emergencies. And then the second part of the podcast will focus on pediatric respiratory emergencies.
Yeah, sounds good. All right, so if the listener feels like they can do some more, feel free. Otherwise, cut it short here.
And thanks for taking the time to listen to our podcast.
I'm Stefan.
And I'm Andrew. Signing off.